Greetings, everybody, and welcome back to the Morning Lineup Podcast. I'm Anthony Castrovince, and today we're talking about this huge Hall of Fame class as announced by the Baseball Writers Association of America on Wednesday evening. It's a four-man class. Chipper Jones, Vladimir Guerrero, Jim Thome, and Trevor Hoffman comprise the 2018 BBWA classes, of course, in addition to the modern era baseball committee's selection of Jack Morris and Alan Trammell in December. So a six-man group total, but it's a large group by baseball writer standards. Second time in the last 4 years that the baseball writers have inducted four men into the Hall of Fame at once, but just the fifth time ever that the BBWA has had a class at least this large. There have been four classes of four men or larger, and of course there was that inaugural class in 1936 that had five members. So a very rare group, a very rare thing to see this many guys grouped together at once. And let's bring in Richard Justice and Joe Posnanski to talk about that. Gentlemen, we're going to get into all these guys' careers, of course, but that's my biggest takeaway is just how much this process has changed just in the last few years. You think back to 2013, it was very controversial that nobody was voted in by the BBWA. Since then, we've had 16 inductees just from the writers in the last 5 years. That's the most in any five-year stretch in the history of the voting.
And I think it's I want to know what Joe thinks, but I think, you know, we had nine players the previous 8 years before this. I think the voting, they have tried to trim the voting rolls. I think they've tried to get, I think as voters get younger, they use more of the tools that helps us assess a player's career. We're not just going by the old thresholds and all of that. I think it's a good thing. And the idea of, I wish Edgar got in. I felt that was my takeaway. I felt terrible for Edgar missing by 20 votes. He's got one chance left. But I like the idea of having six people counting Trammell and Morris going in. That's a cool thing. That's a celebration of baseball and one of the real great days of the summer. But Joe, what do you think is the reason for the big hall approach now?
Well, first of all, I think the big takeaway is that Anthony's voice is back. That's the big takeaway. Last I talked to him, he sounded like he was going to die. So yeah. This is exciting.
He's very emotional about Hall of Fame.
It gets the best of a lot of us. But like Edgar Martinez vote percentages, I'm roaring back to life here. So
you are. You're going in next year, just like he is. Yeah, look, I think a big part of this is there just are more great players coming on the ballot than ever before, just because of expansion and the fact that we're coming off of an era where we just saw a lot of great players. You know, it's you look at the quality of the players that have gone in the last few years. It's not just that we're putting in, you know, four guys or three guys as we have each of the last 4 years. I mean, these are all-time greats. I mean, Maddox and Big Unit and Pedro Martinez and Ken Griffey and Frank Thomas and you know, this year Chipper Jones and Jim Thome, Vlad. I mean, these are all-time great players. And we've been very, very lucky. And it's easy to sort of overlook that we've just gone through sort of another golden age of baseball. And you know, we all know about the PEDs. We all know about the various other issues that baseball, has had to deal with. But we've just gotten to see a lot of extraordinary players in the 1990s and 2000s. And those guys are now coming up on the ballot. And, you know, next year we're going to add Mariano Rivera, the greatest closer in baseball history. I think Edgar goes in next year. So I think the ball just keeps on rolling.
Yeah, the proof is in the pudding when it comes to the sheer number of would-be Hall of Famers on this ballot. I think a lot of us, you know, see more than 10 at any given time. And I had to laugh when I saw the Baseball Hall's official Twitter tweeted out that 50% of the ballots featured the maximum of 10 names. The average ballot contained 8.46 names out of a possible 10. So I don't know, maybe strikes me as a pretty good argument for expanding the vote limit. It's obviously something the baseball writers have pushed for in the past. They pushed to have it moved up to at least 12 to move the needle a little bit, because obviously we've just come to this point where there's just a cavalcade of quality candidates.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, the Hall of Fame is in the interest of the Baseball Hall of Fame to keep the number as low as possible, right? That's they want. Even today, you heard Jeff Idelson say, as he says all the time, and it's a very big point of pride for the Baseball Hall of Fame that only 1% of all baseball players ever make it to Cooperstown. It's the most exclusive hall of them all. They say this again and again, and there's a lot of truth to that. So, you know, I think anything that they feel like in any way lowers those standards, including, you know, making it so you add 12 to the, you know, instead of 10, or figuring out a new way to determine who stays on the ballot rather than just going with the 5%, they're opposed to it. I mean, they really want to keep the standards as high as possible. You know, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
And I think they have nothing to worry about in that realm. I mean, 75%, that's about as close to unanimous as you're ever going to get with this group of voters. So, you know, the threshold is supposed to be high. I remember when Joe Torre, the final time he didn't get in as a player, he said, well, hey, it's the Hall of Fame. It's supposed to be difficult. Now, he had a fallback position as a manager, but I mean, yeah, I think 75% of the vote takes care of that. It's a pretty darn exclusive club.
All right, so let's dig into this 2018 Baseball Writers Hall class, starting with Chipper Jones, who got 97.2% of the vote, and that is actually tied with Greg Maddux for the 10th highest vote total of all time. Here's what Chipper Jones had to say about his induction.
I can't describe it. You know, it's one of those spine-tingling, chill bump moments that you just can't describe. I think having, you know, as you saw, a ton of people here at the house and my mother and father here, it was waterworks, you know, after I got off that phone call. And the only thing I could say to my dad when I hugged him was, we did it. You know, I mean, this has been 35, 36 years in the making, and to have it culminate today with all the people that I love and care about the most being here to share it with me was pretty awesome.
And we are going to bring in MLB.com's Braves reporter Mark Bowman. Of course, knows Chipper Jones very well, maybe too well, Mark, but talk to us about this has obviously been a slew of these Braves getting in the Hall of Fame in recent years. And, you know, this was a foregone conclusion that Chipper would get in the first ballot, but still overwhelming support there in the first year.
Yeah, no doubt. And to see the, you know, to see the level of the percentage that he got, and to put that, you know, in relation to so many others who, you know, great players, legends that have not received that total, it, you know, it doesn't mean he was better than, you know, some of those guys. I mean, we're not going to use that percentage to compare legends, but at the same time, when you start putting his numbers together and realizing you're putting him in categories that only include Babe Ruth, Stan Musial, Lou Gehrig, you know, it's just, it's mind blowing. You know, from a selfish perspective, I count myself very fortunate to have been able to be around him, you know, throughout most of his career, and to cover him here for MLB.com for the last 12 years of his career. This was a special guy. And I just had a chance to be around him for about a half hour, and, you know, he's certainly humbled. You know, he's still walking with his Chipper swagger, of course, think about it. You compare those numbers against all the other switch hitters. The son of a guy who adored Mickey Mantle. He had a bat. You know, his dad had a Mickey Mantle bat in his house. And when Chipper was in Double A, he was going to a signing function that included Mickey Mantle. And he just talked about it. He said, I went to shake his hand and I threw up all over myself, which led one of our other Atlanta reporters say literally. And, you know, what he meant was he just – nothing would come out, you know, and to think, you know, now he's right there with Mickey in that Hall of Fame. It's pretty special.
Yeah, well, you look at some numbers that stand out to me, of course, 1,623 RBIs. That's the most all time among third basemen. He's one of only 9 players with at least 400 home runs, a .300 average, a .400 on base percentage, and a .500 slugging percentage. So rare territory there for Chipper Jones. And Joe, really, you know, third baseman in the Hall of Fame, it's kind of a, you know, overlooked position, but it's not a well-represented position in Cooperstown.
No, it really isn't. It's sort of been a tweener position for years, you know, where very, very good players who played third base, Ron Santo and Joe Torre, you mentioned earlier, and Ken Boyer. I mean, those are guys that were, you know, terrific, great players, Buddy Bell, and they just, you know, didn't really get, you know, the Hall of Fame support. Chipper Jones is another class, though. I mean, he's going in as a third baseman, but he is one of those rare players that it didn't matter where he played. He would have he was such a good hitter, such a good all around hitter. You know, the only switch hitter in baseball history to hit 300 from both sides of the plate. That's what does that tell you? You know, I mean, it just tells you there was no way to turn him around. You were every switch hitter. There's, you know, the manager will think, okay, which side of the plate can this guy hurt us more? Except for Chipper Jones. Chipper Jones could hurt you from either side of the plate in exactly the same way. And there's never been another one like that. You know, I mean, obviously Mickey Mantle is in his own class for the power and the speed and everything else that he did, but for pure hitting, Chipper Jones might be the best pure hitting switch hitter in baseball history.
And Mark, wasn't the consensus number one pick in the 1990 draft. This was a call on the part of Bobby Cox, right? Bobby met with Chipper and just liked what he saw in the kid. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, basically. You know, let's remember that, you know, Van Poppel was, you know, saying he was going to go to college. There was things, you know, surrounding Van Poppel that Bobby didn't like. And Chipper, in his own words, you know, about 20 minutes ago, said, look, I was taken number one overall because I basically fit what they needed. It didn't mean I was the best player in that draft. He said, look, I was exactly what they needed. I was willing to sign for what they were willing to pay. And, you know, this is where I wanted to be. You know, we all know where Todd Van Poppel's career went. Some of the other top names in that draft, I think the next two guys taken were Tony Clark and Mike Lieberthal. You know, he may not have been. He certainly wasn't the consensus pick, but at the same time, it fit. Bobby Cox, he did catch Bobby Cox's eye. You know, Bobby was the GM at the time. And like I said, you know, Van Poppel was talking about going to Texas, I believe. So, you know, you
and losing to, probably go there and lose to West Virginia like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, I think that Chipper said that. Another interesting thing he said tonight was, he said, I wasn't necessarily the best player in that draft. Who knows what would have happened if I hadn't gone to the Braves? He said, I probably would have gone fourth or fifth in that draft. He said, he also said, I wasn't the best player on this ballot by far. He said, you know, Barry Bonds is the best player on that ballot. He said, while we were all fighting to be all-stars, he was, you know, he was the annually placed on the Galactic all-star team. So
nice.
Put a lot of. Gave Barry a lot of love down there, and then had to face the follow-up question with, so would you vote for Barry Bonds? Yeah. And he laughed. He said, I knew that question was coming. So he danced around a little bit, but at the same time, you know, it was to go back and think about how that changed Chipper Jones's life for the Braves to take him and how it changed the Braves franchise. You know, obviously they started running, going to a few World Series before he arrived, but he was that anchor that allowed, significantly influenced the length of time that division title streak lasted.
Yeah, I think of Chipper winning the World Series as a rookie, which is really cool, but he also won a batting title at age 36, which is, you know, remarkable. And Bo, I just want to ask you about that element of his career, you know, battling through the injuries, the knee surgeries. You know, you covered his final years there in Atlanta where he's really just grinding through, but still making things happen on the field.
You know, Chipper Jones is a special talent throughout his whole career. I mean, he played at a Hall of Fame caliber level throughout. But let's go back to 03, 04, you know, maybe even a little bit earlier when he's playing left field and he was dealing with some foot and some hamstring injuries. And I'm a young reporter 3 or 4 years in, and during the off season, I guess I wrote these words like, you know, he's a part-time superstar. And so we ran into each other there right before the start of spring training. And he says to Dave O'Brien, well, this one says I'm a part-time superstar. What I'm, you know, we laughed it off. Anyhow, through those years, you know, he wasn't at the top of his game. I think the most important part of his career might have been what he did there around 2007, 2008 and beyond. Because, you know, at that point in time, he just, you know, while a guy like Andrew Jones's career dipped significantly, Chipper held steady and, you know, in some ways was even better than he was during the early part of the decade. And to think that he had a second left ACL injury in 2010, he had the one in 1994, you know, has another one there in 2010, comes back from that and is a productive player for, you know, the next 2 years. It was, you know, he wasn't, you know, at the top of his game at that point in time. But to think that, that he was able to come back and be as productive as he was shows you the kind of talent this guy had and this the desire to play the game.
I think that's such a fair point, such a good point, because 2006 to 2008, when he was 34 to 36 years old, you know, he never played more than 134 games. He was constantly beat up. I mean, he was missing games, but he was always playing in pain the entire time. His legs were shot. His body was kind of shot. And he put 1,000 OPS up every one of those 3 years. It's you know, he wins a batting title. He has a .470 on base percentage. He leads the league in OPS and OPS plus. And you know, the year before, I mean, and the guy could, you know, he was in agony in so many of those games. It's really, really remarkable. I think that is, he was a better player as a younger guy in a lot of ways because his body was in great shape when he won the MVP, all of that. But I think what he did those 3 years is absolutely remarkable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, throughout his career, he did so many great things on the field. The one thing that will always stick with me is how many players' careers he influenced just because, you know, he understood, you know, a pitcher's approach, how a hit. He could go ahead and break down what a pitcher was going to do. Somewhat, we've heard all the stories about Maddox, you know, being able to anticipate what a hitter was going to do. Chipper had that from a hitting perspective, and he was able to teach some other guys, improve their approach. A guy like Mark DeRosa, Adam LaRoche, Brian McCann, you know, they all benefited greatly from having that opportunity to listen to Chipper. And, you know, I think all of us as reporters, you stand at the Chipper's locker, and if you walk away not having learned something, that then you didn't listen very clearly, or, you know, you certainly are going to be entertained because that you never knew what was going to come out of that mouth. And it usually there was some, and there was always intelligence, and every once in a while there was some orderliness.
Yeah, I'm sure there was some orderliness with how it ended. When you think back to the infield fly rule and that craziness in that wild card game in 2012. But Mark, just kind of tying a bow on this conversation, no pun intended. The Atlanta fans and just this moment of having another inductee from that great run of 14 consecutive division titles, and for all these guys to be first ballot inductees, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, John Smoltz, and now Chipper, and then of course Bobby Cox and John Scherholster, you know, through the smaller committee voting, it just puts a stamp on what an incredible run that really was.
Yeah, you think about it. You know, all of us can think about where you were in 1991 in relation to where you were in 2005. You know, and how many different things changed in your life, and you know, maybe where, you know, where your children went in that period of time, the different development they had. And to think that the Braves, you know, won a division title throughout all those years, and to take a step back and to truly understand how that happened. I mean, you know, obviously the one guy that's missing through the, you know, the one part of this equation, or two people really, you know, you had Ted Turner's money and you had Stan Kasten, who is continuing to show he knows how to spend or lead teams and allocate money in a smart way with professional clubs. But you know, to have Bobby Cox come in during the 80s and alter the, you know, the minor league landscape, you know, change the direction of an organization, for John Scherholz to come in here and cultivate what Bobby had done. And you know, they were fortunate to end up with Greg Maddux. They were fortunate to be able to choose Chipper Jones. And here you are, you know, nearly three decades later, and you take a step back and you say, for over a decade, that they had a team that had Greg Maddux, John Smoltz, Tom Glavine, and Chipper Jones on it, and it was managed by Bobby Cox. That's pretty special.
It is. All right, Bo, thanks for doing this, man. And I'm thinking that, you know, you've covered all these guys going into Cooperstown. Now, you could probably do your own podcast, just like Cooperstown travel tips for the, you know, the baseball fan going to visit the hallowed halls of Cooperstown. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I could draw you a map of all the streets throughout Cooperstown.
Look forward to that. All right, man. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care.
Second in the voting in 2018 was Vladimir Guerrero at 92.9%. And guys, he jumped from, he had a 21.7 point climb from his 2017 total. Last year, finished just 15 votes shy of induction, and just a major surge there in support for Vlad Guerrero. First of all, let's hear what he had to say through interpreter Jose Mota.
First of all, thrilled to be in the Hall of Fame, and he says as many players as come out of the Dominican Republic to be the third Dominican, and with so many outstanding position players that come out of there, what an honor to be the first one to make it to the Hall of Fame. And he thanks Juan Marichal, and of course, the first Dominican inducted into the Hall of Fame, and his big compadre, Pedro Martinez, of course.
Joe, I'll start with you. What do you think of that? It was pretty obvious that Guerrero was going to get in his second year after the strong showing in his first year. But, I mean, that's a remarkable jump up to 92.9%.
Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable jump, and it's a jump that suggests that a lot of people regretted their vote last year. You know, I mean, it really is. I mean, to go all the way up to 93%, basically from 72%, yeah, that's a huge jump. And look, I was one of those people that could not find a place for Vlad on my ballot last year. Look, it helped to knock some people off the ballot too, and kind of get him up there, because, you know, I've always thought he was a Hall of Famer. If I'd had a 12-man ballot like we just talked about, if I had that last year, I would have voted for him last year. So, you know, I think the ballot cleared a little bit for him, which was nice. But look, he's a slam dunk Hall of Famer. He's one of the greatest hitters any of us have ever seen. He's certainly one of the most fun hitters any of us have ever seen. No, I do think sometimes that, you know, being a fun player the way Vlad was, being so entertaining. Look, you have to have the numbers. You have to be an all-time great. But I think you add points to that. I mean, he was so colorful and added so much joy to the game. You know, that's part of what baseball is. And so I think it's wonderful that he's going in. I'm wonderful that he's going in on a big number, too.
Yeah, and I don't know. I didn't vote for him last year either, and I guess it was ballot crowding. I can't figure out another reason because the numbers are there. I mean, it's an easy call. I never saw Clemente play, but if he was any better than Vlad in right field, if he was any more entertaining, if he hit the ball harder, more consistently than Vlad, he was a pretty good player. Two things I remember about him when he was with the Rangers, Ron Washington in 2010, Ron said, we had the talent to win, to get to the World Series. He showed us how to do it. And Nolan Ryan comes out of the clubhouse one day and says, I don't know if I've ever been around a more impressive clubhouse leader than that guy. You know, and I don't really know how much English he speaks, but it didn't matter. He spoke the universal language of baseball, and the guys wanted to follow him and have his poise and production and care about the things he cared about. And in that way, that to me, I think, to the people who played with him and managed him and all of that, those are that's the definition of Vlad Guerrero.
Yeah, I mean, it was an enthusiasm that just carried. I have a memory of him as a fan. I was at a game. I was already a writer, a baseball writer, but I was at a game as a fan with my family, and we were sitting right behind home plate, and I watched him tomahawk a double where the ball was over his head. It just was over his head. And to see it from that angle. And you're close enough to the field, you can sense how fast the pitch is coming in. To watch him do that, he's standing on second base, and I'm still sitting there going, that was physically impossible. It was impossible to do what he just did, and he did that all the time. I mean, he was – what a joy. What a joy that guy was.
An incredible, bad ball hitter, as they say. He said in his call with reporters on Wednesday night that it all went – back to a game he played back home called Plaquita, where you're kind of like a cricket game where you're playing with a broomstick as a bat and have to hit the ball. And he just, you know, he learned to expand his zone that way. But the stat that stuck out to me, guys, was 449 career home runs and a career batting average of .318. The only other players with a batting average that high and at least that many home runs were Babe Ruth, Jimmy Fox, Ted Williams, Lou Gehrig, and Stan Musial. So great company there for Vlad Guerrero. But one thing that stands out to me, Joe, you and I will be at the press conference this afternoon, and that's where Vlad will announce which team he's going to represent in the Hall of Fame, Montreal or the Angels. And there has never been an Angel in the Hall of Fame. He's got to go in as an Angel, right?
I think he does, but no, there's a part of me that wants him to join. I think Tim Raines has already, and Andre Dawson have already sort of tried to push him to go right in as an Expo, right? So look, he's got it cool because, you know, if he goes in as an Expo, that's awesome. If he goes in as the first Angel, that's awesome. If he went in as an Oriole, that would not be as good. Say that up front.
Or a Texas Ranger. Yeah, no.
But it'll be cool, whatever he chooses.
Yeah, he'll either be the first Angel or, you know, in all likelihood, the last Expo. So either way, maybe get some history there. So, all right, let's shift now to a guy near and dear to my heart as a native Clevelander in my mid-30s. The guy I grew up watching is Jim Thome. He got in 89.8% of the vote in his first year of eligibility. He will go in as a Cleveland Indian. Of course, went on to play for the Phillies, the White Sox, the Dodgers, the Twins, for whom he hit his 600th career home run. But and then got to a short stint back with Cleveland late in 2011. But it's an amazing career because we know the home run totals were significantly inflated in the 1990s when Jim Thome came of age. But, you know, the staggering ability to hit the home runs and draw the walks that he did, you know, over 1,700 walks, over 600 home runs, such a rare combination of power and patience.
Yeah, and I like what you tweeted today. Well-known clubhouse troublemaker, Jim Thome. Right. And I would like for you to speak to that, just that of all the players we've known, there's never been anybody nicer or more decent than Jim Thome. And from just the human aspect, 612 home runs aside, this is a very cool thing for a very nice man.
Yeah, I mean, you talk to him and it's impossible not to walk away with just a big smile on your face. And whether the interview amounted to anything at all, you know, who knows? I mean, there's a lot of, for sure, a lot of neats in there with Jim Thome, but he was just a genuine human being, really is. And so, yeah, just personally happy for him on that front. But Joey, you've had many great experiences with Jim Thome over the years. You know, your thoughts on this day as he gets in?
Well, I have to say, I mean, and I think we all feel this way, Richard. I know you felt this way many times, and he's like a friend, you know. I mean, it's not just in his particular case, he is a friend. I know, you know, his wife Andrea and have spent time with him. He's, you know, one of the things that's not very well known about him is that back when the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum was just kind of getting its footing in Kansas City, and it was something that they really needed support, not just monetary support, but support from baseball players to sort of create this legitimacy that they were looking for. One of the most prominent players who was always there for him was Jim Thome. Just year after year, Thome would always win some award because they wanted an excuse to invite him there, but he always deserved some award, and he'd always come. He'd come every year. Whenever they needed him, he would, you know, and most guys, that's the off season. You know, they're on vacation. They're not going to come to Kansas City in the middle of winter to you know, but Jim Thome never missed it, ever. I mean, that just – like you could tell 10 million stories and speaks to his character. You know, late in his career, after I'd done a million things on him, I went to Minnesota to do a story on him for Sports Illustrated. There ended up being a cover story on him in Sports Illustrated. And, you know, it was funny because, Anthony, you said the point. Interviewing Jim is no different than, like, just talking to Jim. Like, you're not going to get, you know, pearls of wisdom from Jim Thome. I mean, that's not what he's about. He's just a modest and gregarious guy. But boy, did his teammates. I mean, in Minnesota, who they barely knew him. He'd only been there for, you know, a year, year and a half. I mean, I didn't even have to talk to Jim because they all had so many incredible things to say about him. And, you know, I remember a couple of them called him the best teammate they'd ever had in Minnesota. I mean, long after his prime. I just think that speaks to who he was. I'm really happy for all of these guys. I really am. They're all good guys and they all, you know, brought so much joy to the game. But I'm a little extra happy for Jim Thome.
Jim Thome looked the part. He had these huge forearms. He was a big guy, a big stature. And at a time, you know, it's cool for guys to hit 612 home runs and strike out a million times. I mean, Jim Thome was seventh all-time in walks, and his career on-base average was 400. I don't think he ever struck out 200 times, although he did lead the league in strikeouts a couple of times. So what you saw is what we saw. I mean, he was the classic slugger. And the big guy that had a great disposition and everyone loved the guy. I can remember being in a clubhouse celebration with him in Arlington. I think he was playing for the Orioles at the time. And he just You just had the feeling this was the happiest guy in the world, you know. And I think he was with the Orioles for about an hour and 20 minutes, but it was just part of who he was. He thought putting on the uniform was an honor.
An honor. They you know, in Minnesota, they used to have a thing where they'd walk up to him before a game and they'd say, "Hey, Jim, how's the charisma today?" And Jim would always say, "Charisma's good. Charisma's good. We're going to hit one out today. I feel something good's going to happen today." I mean, it was, and it would be every single day. And that's just who he is. I mean, this is, boy, is that going to be a wonderful moment when he gets up there on the stage and he'll break down. Don't you think? Of these guys, I was trying to think of four of them going in, which one was the most, they'll probably all break down to some point, but which one is the most likely to break down? I think Jim's breaking down, right?
As Jimmy would say, for sure, for sure. You know, he's going in the Hall of Fame, but he's been to the Hall of Fame before. He actually hand-delivered the baseballs from his 500th and 600th home runs to the Hall of Fame. So let's hear from the man himself. Here's what Jim Thome had to say on the night he was elected into the Hall of Fame.
When you become a Hall of Famer, everybody sees the big stats. They see the numbers. But what I don't think they see is the downsides that we all as players go through, and those long hours with guys like Charlie Manuel, who I would not be here today without Charlie, and my father, all the countless hours as a kid having dad throw me batting practice, hit ground balls. It's much more than all the things that people see. I think it's about sweat equity and getting after it and understanding every day you're a Major League Baseball player, you have to look in the mirror and there's going to be positives, there's going to be negatives that you have to overcome, those offers. But how do you adapt and come back the next day and adjust to what they're doing to you?
So, guys, I just love the story in general. I'm beyond being a nice guy. It's just a great story. This country strong slugger plucked out of the 13th round of the draft and then he starts to point his bat like Roy Hobbs in The Natural and goes on his great career. And yeah, the stat that struck out to me here is that his on-base percentage of .402, 1 point higher than that of Ricky Henderson. So you combine that with the 612 home runs and you have quite an amazing career. So congrats to Jim Thome. And last but not least in our class of four here in 2018, Trevor Hoffman closing it out, appropriately so. last year, finished just 5 votes shy of induction. Just agonizingly, tantalizingly close. You figured he'd finish the job eventually, and of course he does here in 2018, achieving 79.9% of the vote. Here's what Mr. Hoffman had to say.
Well, I certainly have, you know, the idea of this day coming is one that you really have a hard time letting yourself go to think about because you don't want to jinx anything. And so while it's finally here, it's really harder to put into words. I think as Chipper and Jim and Vlad have said, it's something that we've all worked for. There's a lot of sweat equity and the opportunity to get to this point, but to ultimately have the reality hit, it's hard to describe.
So, guys, can we get Hell's Bells playing on the day in Cooper? Do they allow that sort of thing in Cooperstown? I'm not sure.
They should.
Yeah, he's got to have that. You know, he was a guy. What I loved about him is he showed that pitching is art. And he developed this changeup, and it transformed his career. He's a guy you could take out to a tryout camp, and their scouts might not phone home to get a big signing bonus. Craig Biggio told me one time, he said, "I know he's going to throw me the changeup. He knows I know he's going to throw me the changeup. And the arm action is so perfect, I can't stop myself from lunging at it." And that's the definition of a guy who figured out a way to succeed in the game, and also a very, very fine human being.
Yeah, just a class act. And, you know, it's funny because almost nobody tells this story. He wasn't a pitcher. Right. He came out of he was a shortstop. He was a shortstop when he was drafted. Wasn't drafted high. Nobody thought he was really a big prospect. He was drafted in, what, the 11th, 12th round, something like that, 11th round. And he was a shortstop, and he couldn't hit. He was a no-hit shortstop, seeming to head nowhere. And, you know, what's different about him is you'll see guys get, you know, hey, he's a former shortstop, and suddenly they see he has a great arm, so he's going to become a pitcher because he can't hit. I mean, that's happened. Those stories happen. Trevor Hoffman doesn't have that great an arm. I mean, you know, he threw, at that point, he was still probably getting close to 90, but it wasn't like they saw him, you know, his arm, and they went, oh my gosh, this guy is, he's incredible. I mean, he's going to blow people away. That, and he certainly wasn't that as a major league pitcher. It was that changeup, which is, you know, one of the five best changeups in baseball history, that made him. So that is a really, really unusual story for a guy to not only convert from an everyday player to a pitcher, but to convert because of sort of an off-speed right. pitch that nobody really knew what to make of. I mean, it's an amazing career, and you know, 600 saves. After next year, when certainly Mariano Rivera is going to go in, I don't know that we're ever going to see another 600 save guy. I mean, think how hard that is to do. That's 40 saves a year for 15 years. They're not going to be too many of those in baseball history.
Yeah, note to every light hitting shortstop in low A who's worried about the future of his career, just start throwing the changeup and see what happens. That's what worked for Trevor Hoffman, and goes on to throw 1,089 and a third career innings and a walks and hits per inning pitch mark of 1.058, ninth all time. Is also fifth all time among those who started after 1920. So just incredible. The limitation of traffic and the ability to close out games. He was, I was going to say second to none, but second to one. Mario Rivera, who will of course go in next year and starting to see more relievers pop into the Hall of Fame. There had only been five relievers prior to Trevor Hoffman. He becomes the sixth, and Rivera will become the seventh. So nice to see those guys get their due. But gentlemen, let's move on to the guys who didn't make it. And of course, Edgar Martinez tops that list. And he was kind of him and Hoffman were kind of the bubble guys going into Wednesday night. If you looked at the polling, it was pretty clear that Jones, Guerrero, and Tomy were getting in. Hoffman and Martinez kind of on the bubble. Edgar was polling really well. And it's really amazing to see the surge that, you know, his candidacy has taken here in recent years. So he finished, as I said, just 20 votes shy here in 2018. And, you know, in all likelihood, or maybe this is just cautiously optimistic on my part, but you'd assume he makes that gap up next year in his final year on the ballot. Certainly hope so. But it's amazing to think how far he's come in a short time. You go back to 2014, he was polling at 25.2%, then went up to 35, 36, 33. He went up to 27, 43, 58.6 last year, and now up around 70% here in 2018. So it seems like one of those cases where the internet has really chimed in on this. I'm sure being tied to one team, you know, having a really strong fan base there in Seattle and those people advocating for him has helped his cause as well. But it's really remarkable how far his candidacy has come in a short time.
Yeah, you know, I would say I would say this is a good year for Edgar Martinez, even though he did fall short and it looked like he maybe was on the bubble. I think those of us who have been following it, all three of us here, and I think all the people listening who follow the Hall of Fame, you know, with a little extra care, knew how this was going to go, right? Because even though he and Hoffman were almost the same on the tracker, on the Ryan Thibodeau tracker, Hoffman was at 78.5%, Edgar was at 77.2%, but we all knew that the private ballots are going to be good to Hoffman. They always are. He actually got a boost with the private ballots. He got 81.8% of the vote. You know, the private ballot people like saves a lot. So he got a nice boost and he made it. We kind of knew Edgar wasn't going to make it, or at least I felt like that was the likely thing. He only got 61% of those private votes. The DH thing still hurting him a little bit there. But overall, I think terrific year for Edgar Martinez. He's going to get in next year. I think this puts him right on the bubble. He is absolutely going to get in next year, in my view. And, you know, it's a shame it didn't happen this year. I don't like when guys have to wait any extra time. It seems silly to me. But I think he pretty much secured his way to Cooperstown this year.
Yeah, I feel the same way you felt. I was really anxious about both Edgar and Trevor Hoffman. I was thinking, for Trevor to miss by five votes last year, and now he's on the bubble again because the public and private ballots seem to be adjust. Although, as you said, with Trevor, it went up. It stresses me out about Edgar. His final year on the ballot, is he going to make up those 20 votes? I don't know what more the guy can do. I don't want to, like you said, Joe, it's not right to berate a guy, a voter that disagrees with you. But this guy was a dominant offensive player, both anecdotally and statistically. I mean, his on base average is the 21st highest of all time. I mean, they could not get him out. And not only that, pitchers would tell us he was the toughest guy I ever faced. I mean, if that's how you, I mean, to me, that's how you measure a Hall of Fame. It has to be things you see and things his teammates and opponents say about him. And Edgar crosses every threshold. So he's down to the 10th time. You know, I always thought this about Blylevin and some of those guys. Maybe you're going to appreciate it. Jack Morris. Maybe you'll appreciate it a little more that it took so long. You know, I hope it's not bittersweet. And I certainly hope he gets those 20 votes next year.
Yeah, I think you will. I think you will. You know, look, your point about he can't do any more, that's really the silly part of all of this, right? None of these guys can do any more. You know, I mean, Edgar Martinez is no better a baseball player today than he was 9 years ago when he came on the ballot. I mean, it's absurd that it has to go this way. But, you know, for guys like him, it is a little bit of a subtle case. He's a DH. His career was not that long. He came up pretty late. I mean, he really wasn't a full-time player until he was 28, 27. So, you know, I get why it sort of has taken a while. But the thing is, we all know he's going to go in. We all know he should go in. And, you know, for it to have to come down to next year, look, it'll be just as sweet, if not sweeter for him. And it's great. And you're right. There is always that slight nervousness that maybe he'll fall two votes short. And what a travesty that would be. But I bet you he makes it and makes it comfortably next year.
Yeah, I feel the same way you felt. I was really anxious about both Edgar and Trevor Hoffman. I was thinking, if for Trevor to miss by 5 votes last year, and now he's on the bubble again because the public and private ballots seem to be adjust. Although, as you said, with Trevor, it went up. It stresses me out about Edgar. His final year on the ballot, is he going to make up those 20 votes? I don't know what more the guy can do. I don't want to, like you said, Joe, it's not right to berate a guy, a voter that disagrees with you, but this guy was a dominant offensive player, both anecdotally and statistically. I mean, his on base average is the 21st highest of all time. I mean, they could not get him out. And not only that, pitchers would tell us he was the toughest guy I ever faced. I mean, if that's how you, I mean, to me, that's how you measure a Hall of Fame. It has to be things you see and things his teammates and opponents say about him. And Edgar crosses every threshold. So he's down to the 10th time. You know, I always thought this about Blylevin and some of those guys. Maybe you're going to appreciate it. Jack Morris. Maybe you'll appreciate it a little more that it took so long. You know, I hope it's not bittersweet. And I certainly hope he gets those 20 votes next year.
Yeah, Pedro Martinez and Mo Rivera have both said that Edgar Martinez was the toughest hitter they ever faced. So, I don't know. That's good enough for me. But a guy who's kind of had a similar track here in recent years is Mike Mussina. This was his fifth year out of 10 eligible years on the ballot. And Mussina, so his first year, he got 20% of the vote. Second year, 25%. Third year, 43%. Then 52% last year. And this year, guys, he finishes at 63.5%. So, things are definitely trending in the right direction for Moose as well.
I keep looking at his numbers, and he's a guy that I know well, that I covered the Baltimore part of his career and some of the New York part of his career. I know how smart he is and what a competitor he is. And I keep looking at the numbers. You know, we say maybe he could come back and win a couple more games. I don't know what people are looking at when they don't vote for this guy. And he and Schilling both pitched at a time when the ballparks got smaller, the strike zone was the size of a postage stamp at times, and they were dominant guys. Mike Mussina won 270 games. And, you know, I mean, he was a Gold Glove winner. He six times in 10 years, he was top five in Cy Young voting. That, to me, is what sort of separates a Hall of Famer. You're good over a long period of time.
All right, so we got to talk about Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. We heard Mark Bowman earlier say that Chipper Jones was, you know, waxing poetic about Barry Bonds, of course, being the best player of his time. And but of course, we know the controversy associated with these two gentlemen. It's interesting to me, guys. Barry Bonds finished with the same number of votes as last year. Clemens actually picked up 3 votes. So they see, and just because the voting pool changed a little bit, they actually saw slight upticks in their percentages. But really, they treaded water. And this was the year, of course, of the Joe Morgan email, basically imploring the writers to not vote in the so-called steroid guys. But, you know, to basically lose a year, this was their sixth year on the ballot. So four more cracks at it. But as I said, they basically treaded water this year.
Yeah, they really did. They really did. I've been probably a little bit more. A lot of people disagree with me on this particular subject, but I think that the Morgan letter, it ended their chances to get into the Hall of Fame through the BBWAA. I really do. First of all, I don't know that it's the last time we're going to get that letter. I think that letter is going to sort of resurface every year, would be my guess. And, you know, those guys were making real progress. I mean, there was momentum building for them. They both gained 40 votes, 40 plus votes last year, and they essentially gained nothing this year, nothing. And, you know, I know there are people that say, oh, nobody's, Joe Morgan's letter is not going to change anybody's mind. No, it's not going to change anybody's mind. And they're going to be those that are going to be, you know, feel like, hey, Joe Morgan can't tell me what to do. Sure, there are going to be some of those, but they need 75% of the vote. And where are they going to get those votes? I mean, I think what Joe Morgan's letter does, and, you know, I think especially because I do believe it is a semi-official position of the Hall of Fame, is to reinforce those that don't believe that more that either of those guys should go to the Hall of Fame. So, you know, they gained nothing this year. They really did tread water. There are 20 fewer voters this year, so that's why their percentage is upticked. But, I mean, they gained nothing this year, and I really truly believe that the Hall of Fame has stepped in and kind of blunted their momentum, and I don't see how it's going to come back. I really don't.
I don't. It bothers me that two of the 10 greatest players of all time are not in the Hall of Fame. And if you just take their numbers, take Rogers' career in Boston, take Bond's career before 2001, the numbers are overwhelming. And I think any of those Hall of Famers up there on the stage that played with them, for them, I mean, with them or against them, would acknowledge their greatness. By the time Roger got to Houston, he was throwing 89, 91 miles an hour, but he was getting by on grit and all of that. He would go through a game and walk two guys in the first inning, two guys in the third inning, and the manager, Phil Garner, would be on the top step of the dugout going, I got to go get this guy. I'm not going to let him embarrass himself. And then the next thing you know, it'd be 6 2/3 innings, one run. You know, he just knew how to pitch. And I'm going to just say this. It's not black and white. Roger Clemens was a great ambassador for the game his last 10 years. I saw the acts of kindness he did for minor leaguers, helping them in all sorts of ways. I was in a clubhouse in Lexington, Kentucky once, and he'd hit a kid. I was in there talking, hey, what does it feel like to be hit by Roger Clemens? And Clemens walks in and starts talking to the kid. Hey, are you okay? Blah, blah, blah. They start talking. The kid convinces Roger to spend the night in Lexington and go help him with a bullpen the next day. And it wasn't even in the same organization. And he loved that stuff. The Astros used to hold mini camps in the winter with Nolan Ryan and Roger Clemens tutoring young pitchers. So my point is that, look, whatever they did, they did. Their ambition and their judgment got mixed up and all this stuff. But it's not as black and white as good guy, bad guy. And I don't feel that them being in the Hall of Fame would stain Cooperstown. And also, if you don't want guys that use steroids in the Hall of Fame, then just tell us who used. You know, otherwise, we're going to bestow the highest honor on the guys that got away with it and punish the guys that got caught, or we're just going to play a guessing game with it. But, you know, when we went down this road into steroids, we knew we would be approaching, we would confront uncomfortable conversations like this.
Well, yeah, I don't know how much you've had to deal with this, Richard, but over the last 3, 4, 5 days, I've done 50, whatever, radio things and television things. Every single one of them yelled at me for voting for Bonds and Clemens.
Right.
Everyone.
And it's the only thing they want to talk about.
The only thing they want to talk about, because they have this strong opinion. Cheaters don't belong in the Hall of Fame. And these guys were cheaters. They cheated the game and they cheated other people and all these other things. And I just want to say to them, look, I'm not going to disagree with you or argue with you about whether they cheated the game. What I'm going to tell you is the Baseball Hall of Fame is for the greatest players of all time, which they are. And I'm also going to tell you that Babe Ruth corked his bat, and Ty Cobb bet on baseball, and Mickey Mantle used steroids, and dozens and dozens of players used amphetamines, and Gaylord Perry spit on baseballs, and Whitey Ford cut baseballs, and players since the beginning of time have gone for every edge they possibly could to win and do to this day. And I get that what they did, you want to make it worse than what all those other things are, fine. You can make it worse. You can say it's worse, even though there were no testing. There was nothing. There was no even external pressure on those people. But if you want to say it's worse, fine. But what you're really doing is you are using them specifically as the scapegoats for a time that you're upset about. And I don't think it's right. I don't think it's right. I think if Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds, particularly Bonds, had been a more likable personality, he'd be in the Hall of Fame. But because they were not particularly likable, particularly Bonds, again, Clemens at the end sort of developed that as well. I think people are more than happy to make them pay the price for a game that really it took a long time for the game to catch up to where it should be. And by the way, there are steroid users in the Hall of Fame. We all know it. We all know it. We've all voted for them, right?
Yeah, and not just that. In the 50s, I know players that injected themselves. Well, I think they're mostly dead now, but they injected themselves with substances thinking they would get an advantage. Obviously, right. They were not. I don't know that they were control. I don't even know that there were controlled substances in the 50s, and the weight training was not sophisticated enough. The point is, from the beginning of time, players have looked for every advantage. And I think if you sat down with Frank Robinson and Willie Mays and said, if someone offered you blah, 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 it's at least a difficult conversation.
Well, I'll tell you what. Buck O'Neill, my friend, my idol, guy, the person I wrote my first book about, great Negro Leagues player, manager, everything else. I got an email the other day from a very nice kid. And the kid was basically pleading with me to not vote for Bonds and Clemens. He had seen me on one of these shows where I was getting yelled at, and he pleaded with me. And he said in the email, he said, you know, I wish you would think more about your friend Buck O'Neill. I'm sure Buck O'Neill would not want those guys in the Hall of Fame. It's 100% untrue. Buck O'Neill was absolutely convinced that both of them were two of the greatest players of all time. He said the only reason we didn't use steroids is because we didn't have them. He was adamant that those guys should not be scapegoated for doing something that, let's face it, a large number of players were doing. So, yeah, you know what? I mean, I think they are going to pay the price. I think we can talk about it all we want. But I think what upsets me, especially after the last few days, is just the mind-numbing certainty of people that these two guys, as long as you keep them out of the Hall of Fame is going to be this pristine place. It's lunacy. It's just lunacy.
Yeah. The point of PEDs is not that they make you hit a home run or make you throw 100 miles an hour. The point of PEDs is they allow you to post up night after night after night and do those incredible athletic feats, much like, I mean, that's what amphetamines did for generations. So that the conversation makes me crazy. And obviously, you know, we're talking about guys who probably went a step beyond because of the, you know, chemical enhancements available to them at the time. But your point about Buck O'Neill, what he said is absolutely spot on, in my opinion. Whatever was available to players, that's what players used. And the game did nothing to police it in the time where Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens were doing the amazing things they were doing on the field. So it's a difficult one. The only thing that stands out to me, Joe, and your hypothesis may very well be correct about the Joe Morgan letter. I have no reason to doubt that it is. My only note on that is just that among first-time voters that were tracked by Ryan Thibodeau's tracking system, there were 11 first-time voters, and those guys did very well among them. Bonds at 90.9%, Clemens at 100%. Now, you know, what percentage of the vote that'll make up in the next 4 years, who knows? But it just seems to me, generally speaking, as the voting body starts to skew a little younger each year, people in my generation, younger generation, they don't seem to care as much about the so-called cheating element. They just say, put the best players in the Hall of Fame. So that seems to be where that vote is headed. So,
yeah, I hope you're right. But I will say this. If, let's say, Barry Bonds picked up 10 first-time votes, 10 new votes, which is really exciting, that means he lost 10 old votes.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the reality here. The reality is that there were some people who you know, and look, I'm not saying that the only reason they did this is Joe Morgan letter. I'm just saying that when the Hall of Fame gives a directive like that, when the vice chairman of the Hall of Fame sends a letter out, it's pretty clear where the Hall of Fame stands on this subject. And you can vote against that if you want. I did. Richard did. And you know, we'll continue to, because I think that those guys belong in the Hall of Fame. But But you have a pretty strong leg to stand on if you say, hey, the Hall of Fame doesn't want those guys. You know, I mean, that's that argument is there for you now if you want it. So I hope you're right, though. I really do. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope that the Joe Morgan letter or whatever the case may be, that those guys at least start getting more momentum so we can start having a real conversation about them instead of this just back and forth, you know, I'm right, you're wrong kind of thing.
And then Curt Schilling was the other guy who finished north of 50%. He had a mild uptick of a 17 vote gain in 2018. But I wanted to talk about some guys who were the first year of eligibility and did not get in, of course, but Omar Vizquel, Scott Rolen, Andrew Jones, Johan Santana, Johnny Damon, that group there. You know, we talked about Omar in our preview of the Hall of Fame announcement the other day, and he finished at 37%. Scott Rolen finished at 10.2%. Joe, I know he was on your ballot, a little strategic voting going on there. Andrew Jones, 7.3%. He was in, you know, real danger of, you know, getting below the 5% threshold to even stay on the ballot for next year, but he just makes it above that. Johan Santana did fall off at 2.4%, and Johnny Damon did at 1.9%. But basically, that first year crew, what stood out to you from that group, Joe?
Well, first of all, big year for Omar Vizquel. I mean, 37% is that's a sizable first year on the ballot. I mean, that is more than several players who ended up in the Hall of Fame over the last decade. You know, Jim Rice. It's more than Jim Rice. It's more than Bruce Sutter, Goose Gossage, Burt Blyleven. I mean, there's a bunch of guys that did not debut as high as Omar Vizquel. So big win for Vizquel this year. Really, really surprised that so many people were in love with the Vizquel case and were not in love with the Andrew Jones case. That was baffling to me. I mean, Vizquel's case is that he was an all-time great defender and hit enough, right? That he did enough on his offense. He had 2,800 hits. But his whole case is really built on defense. Well, you know, Andrew Jones, his whole case is built on defense. Plus, he had 400 home runs. So I'm surprised there's that big a gap between them. To me, they have the same case. And I would argue that Jones's case is a little more compelling to me from those two. So that was interesting. I thought very, very interesting that Rolen made it, which I thought was great, but he didn't make it by much. I thought it was fascinating that Johan Santana and Jamie Moyer both ended up with 10 votes. I don't know how that happened. No offense to Jamie Moyer, who was a, you know, fine pitcher for a very long time and one of the really cool stories of the game and a big, big fan. Oh, Johan Santana won 2 Cy Youngs. He was the best pitcher in baseball for like 8 years. And he got no more support than Jamie Moyer. Jamie Moyer, by the way, all 10 of his votes on the private ballots. So I don't know what's going on, what those guys are, you know, the private guys are doing. Maybe they're sitting in a room kind of talking this through. But some reason those guys love Jamie Moyer, but didn't have a whole lot of use for Johan Santana. I'm sad. I'm sad that Santana didn't make the ballot for next year and sad that this probably ends his chances. I don't think that the Veterans Committee will dive to pick him up. So I'm a little sad about that. But the big winner by far is Omar Vizquel.
Sometimes private ballots are private for a reason. I think that's the lesson there.
Do you think the guy who voted for Carlos Lee wants to keep his ballot quiet?
Oh, and you know, we didn't get any token votes for Orlando Hudson, Aubrey Huff, Jason Isringhausen, Brad Lidge, Kevin Millwood, Carlos Zambrano. Where's like the hometown newspaper guy, you know, giving those guys their one bit of love? I always love the single vote. But you mentioned, yeah, Carlos Lee and Livan Hernandez were the guys this year, kind of like Mr. Irrelevant in the NFL draft. Those are the guys who got one vote. So there's always fascinating things to dive into with these ballots. And same thing, you know, during the awards voting season, when you can really delve into the percentages and some of the, you know, strategy or what have you. It's really fascinating. But Richard, anything jump out to you from that group?
No, I'm just happy. I'm relieved that Andrew Jones lives to fight another day. I don't know that he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but I know he belongs in the conversation. He was a dominant player at what he did for a decade. And I'm sad about Johan Santana. I would like, you know, with a 10 ballot limit, I don't know how he gets on anybody's ballot, but between 2002 and 2010, right, it was unbelievable how great the guy was. His ERA, yeah, well, you know, we talk about Clemens, Well, Santana's ERA was better than Clemens. I mean, it was a joke. He was one of those guys that when you faced him before the injuries, when you faced him, that slider, you didn't get any hits off of him. And, you know, I think we all rooted for him to get it back and get another run with the Mets. And his shoulder just never bounced back. And, but yeah, I don't know that he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but I know that he belongs in the conversation and he's not going to be there. But, you know, as Joe's made the point many times, every guy that was on the ballot, there's at least some discussion to be had. And any guy other than that got 5% of the vote or something like that was a special player. But, you know, the 10 ballot limit is a problem for some of those guys.
No question. No question. There are two other guys I'd want to mention real quick. You mentioned Schilling. Schilling got 38% of the private ballot. 38%. I mean,
that wasn't just his Twitter followers either.
I would say those are not. Yeah, maybe those were. Maybe the 38% are the only ones that are his Twitter followers. He's absolutely talked himself out of the Hall of Fame. I mean, it's at this moment, and he can still turn it around. He still has a little bit of time. But right now, I mean, it's, you know, like I say, for a while there, he was sort of coupled with Mussina, but there is now separation. Mussina's moved into a whole different category, and I think it's going to be tough for Curt Schilling, which is a shame. I mean, it was, you know, a fantastic career and a postseason performances like nobody else. But he really, really is not gaining anything. But a guy who did gain, and I thought that was really, really nice, was Larry Walker. Larry Walker went up 10 points this year. It's probably too late. He only has 2 years left on the ballot. But people are beginning to realize what a special player Larry Walker was. I think the next 2 years are going to be a pretty good opportunity for him. He'll be the best non-Barry Bonds outfielder on the ballot, or Barry, Manny Ramirez, the PED guys. He'll be the best sort of non-PED guy on the ballot who played the outfield. Maybe he'll make a big move. I mean, that I think he's a guy to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and I want to say this, Joe, about I think people like you talk to Edgar and Larry and the internet as a whole, Twitter as a whole, really talk them up and force voters to take another look at their careers. And I'm just wondering, there is not that – and maybe Mussina the same way, but there is not that support for Schilling. Why do you think that is? Is this just because people don't – I mean, is he right when he says people don't like him? Is that it? They don't vote for him because they don't like him?
Yeah, people don't like him. I mean, people don't like guys who retweet white supremacists. I mean, you know, I mean, that's – let's be honest. I mean, yeah. I don't like him. I vote for him. I don't like him. You know, and I think some of the stuff, look, when it was political, I think he had an argument. Like when he's like, hey, look, I just happen to be a Trump guy or I happen to be a Republican. Yeah, you don't hold that stuff against him. But when he's, you know, retweeting guys who are talking about hanging journalists and is retweeting white supremacists and you know, saying things about Muslims, that crosses politics. That's not about politics anymore.
You advocate one murder and suddenly they won't let you, they won't give you the highest honor in the game. And I say this as someone that votes for him. I mean, I think his numbers are off the charts. He and Mussina, I don't think it's a conversation. You know, the thing is, I was going to say, if you know him, you like him a little more. But I think even people that know him don't really like him anymore. Well, so
here's what's interesting. I had a pretty good relationship. Not pretty good, really good relationship with Curt Schilling. Curt Schilling started game one of the 2001 World Series. And I wrote a story, a column. I was working for the Kansas City Star at the time. And I wrote a column. And this was kind of, the internet was sort of in its early days. And it wasn't like you wrote something for the Star and people read it all over the country. I mean, it was, people just read it in Kansas City. And I wrote something about him and his dad. You remember he used to leave a ticket for his father. His father had died. But he always left a ticket and an empty seat in the stadium for his father when he pitched, which I always thought was sweet. There's, look, the guy you mentioned about Clemens. I mean, Curt Schilling did a lot of good for a lot of people.
Yes.
I mean, Curt Schilling has been an extremely charitable guy. So anyway, I wrote this piece I wake up the next morning and, you know, I'm sort of early days of email or whatever. There's an email from Curt Schilling. I'd never met him before. I'd never talk to him other than in like in a scrum. And it was an email from Curt Schilling thanking me for the story that I'd written about him in the Kansas City Star, you know, several hours after pitching game one of the World Series. And, you know, my two thoughts were, one, I thought that was very kind of him to do that. I mean, there are only a handful of players that I've dealt with who would go out of their way to do something like that. Jim Thome being one of those guys. There's only a handful of guys like that. I thought that was one. Two, I thought there's something wrong with somebody who's looking for stories about himself right after he pitched game one of the World Series.
That's true. That's correct.
But we had numerous conversations after that. And, you know, look, we didn't see eye to eye necessarily, but I admired his pitching. I admired the good things he did for people. He was another guy that really stood out and spoke out for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in the early days. So I thought there was a lot that was admirable about him, but, you know, I mean,
yeah, like and he was a compelling guy in the way he turned his career around, the work ethic. And I just found him sort of a delight to be around. And then he gets out of the game.
It kind of changed.
Yeah. I just saw a picture of him outside Quincy Market a couple of months ago, holding a rally with some people that maybe Kurt shouldn't be associated with.
There you go. Exactly.
Well, what I learned from this is that Curt Schilling had Google alerts before Google even existed, apparently. So he found Joe's column. But all right. Well, gentlemen, next year, Mo Rivera, Todd Helton, Miguel Tejada, Andy Pettitte, Roy Halladay. It doesn't get any easier is what I'm saying. Still will be some difficult decisions on next year's ballot, but we'll get into that in due time. Until then, my thanks to Joe Posnanski and to Richard Justice and to Mark Bowman for joining us today. And thanks to you all for tuning in. We'll see you soon.